their correct positions. Hobbs, it's quite simple, really. It seems I have fallen in love. She found that her breath had stopped. Time had stopped. Sir? She managed. And the thing is, Hobbs, it seems that love is more important than empire. Yes, sir, was all she could say. But I am still your captain, as before, he said. I shall still follow the Navy's orders, if not every tradition. No need to worry about my loyalties. Of course not, sir. I never doubted you, sir. This changes nothing, Captain. It changed everything. Hobbs allowed herself to feel for a moment, tentatively, to sample the torrent of emotions that built inside her. They poured from her heart, ravenous and almost frighteningly strong, and she had to clench her teeth to keep them from her face. She nodded carefully and allowed herself a smile. It's okay, Laurent. It's human. With an effort of will, she rose. Perhaps we should continue this conversation after the battle with the Ricks is concluded. It was the only possible solution. The only way to survive was to push this down into hiding for another 10 days. Zai glanced rightward, where she knew he kept the current time in his secondary sight, and nodded in agreement. Right, Hobbs. Always efficient. Thank you, sir. They took a step together toward the door, and then he grasped her shoulder. A warmth spread from that contact through her body. It was the first time he had touched her in 2 years. She turned to him, her eyes half closing. She sent that message, he said softly. She? Sir? When I went to the observation blister to kill myself, he said, there was a message. It was from her. From her? She repeated, her mind unable to pass the words. My beloved, he said, an out-of-character beatific smile upon his face. A single word that made all the difference. Catherine Hobbs felt a chill spreading through her. Don't, the message said. And I didn't, he continued. She saved me. There it was again. She, not you. Yes, sir. Laurent's hand slipped from her shoulder. Now the cold in Hobbs was absolute. It stilled her raging emotions. Like a killing frost, it cut down the part of her that was confused, devastated. Soon she would be ready to go on. She just had to keep standing here without feeling for these next few seconds, and everything would be back the way it was. Thank you, Hobbs, Captain Zai said. I'm glad you asked. It's good to tell someone. Very well, sir, she answered. The briefing, sir? Of course. They walked there together, her eyes forward, so as not to see the unfamiliar expression on her captain's face. Happiness. Senator. We approve the attack without objection. Senator Nara Oxum said the words quietly, almost talking to herself. Roger Niles frowned and said, The Lynx would be just as doomed if you'd forced a vote. Losing 8-1 isn't much of a moral victory. A moral victory, Niles? Oxum asked, a faint smile softening the bitterness on her face. I've never heard you use that term before. You won't hear it again. It's a contradiction in terms. You did the right thing. Nara Oxum shook her head slowly. She'd signed a death warrant for her lover and for another 300 men and women, all for the political advantage of a despot. Surely this could not be the right thing. Senator, these won't be the last lives the War Council will vote to sacrifice, Niles said. This is war. People die. There are real strategic arguments for sending the Lynx against that battlecruiser. The Empire simply has no idea what the Ricks are up to. We don't know why they want to contact the Legia's compound mind. It might be worth a frigate to keep the beast cut off. Might be, Niles? It's in the nature of war to frustrate the enemy, even if you're not sure exactly what they're doing. Do you really think so? Nara asked. The man nodded. The Emperor and his admirals aren't about to sacrifice a starship just to revenge a slight. The Lynx may be small, but she's the most advanced warship in the Spinwood reaches. Even an insult from a grey hero like Laurent Zai wouldn't warrant throwing her away. You should have heard them, Niles. They laughed with pleasure at making him a martyr, called him a cripple, Nara put her head in her hands and leaned back, letting the luxuriant visitor's couch take her form. She and Niles were in one of the docking spires above the forum, tall spindles of crystal that sprouted from the senatorial grounds to tower over the capital. The spire rooms were used primarily to impress ambassadors and to entertain the odd powerful constituent. They were intimate despite their commanding views, the Senate's subtle answer to the imperial glories of the Diamond Palace and the Holy Orbitals. Their slightly musty furnishings spoke of collegiality and chumminess, of retail politics and handshake deals. Oxum and Niles had evicted the spire room's previous occupants. Council rank had its privileges, for a hasty meeting before she returned to the Diamond Palace. The Senator's Palace flyer waited just outside, bobbing softly in the cold morning breeze. Nara hadn't known that the term docking spires was literal, but the flyer's AI had chosen the spire, recognizing that Oxum had little time for a landing. Council would meet again in 20 minutes. "I don't know what's worse," Oxum admitted. "The Emperor killing Xi for revenge, or me voting to commit the Lynx for purely tactical reasons, agreeing with the overwhelming majority so that they'd listen to me when a close vote came up." "That's sound thinking, Senator. You don't want to be branded as weak and unwilling to shed blood." "But actually to agree with them," she continued, "to sacrifice 300 lives on the merest assumption that troubling the Ricks is worth the cost, that's harder to swallow than a tactical concession, Niles." Her old counselor stared back at her. He looked diminutive on the over-cushioned divan, a sharp-faced elf in the salon of some corpulent satrap. His eyes narrowed, bright blue and exceptionally sharp. There was no second sight here, 10 kilometers above the concentrated synesthesia projectors of the forum's chambers. "You've made distasteful compromises before, Nara," he said. "Yes, I've traded my vote before," she answered warily. It was Niles's way to debate her when she doubted herself, to bully her into understanding her own motives. "What's the difference this time?" he asked. She sighed, feeling like a schoolgirl repeating rote lessons. "In the past I've bargained with the Empire's wealth. I've dealt tax relief for patent enforcement, access protections for trading rights. 90% of Senate policy is pure economics, a matter of possession. I've never traded in lives before." Niles looked out the window, his gaze oriented on the dented hills over which dawn was breaking through distant black clouds. "Senator, did you know that the suicide rate in the Empire has been consistent since the first Ricks incursion?" "Suicide rate?" Oxum thought. "What was Roger talking about?" She shrugged. "The population is so large, its economic power so dispersed, that sort of consistency is just the weak law of large numbers at work. Any local spikes or troughs in suicides are subsumed within the whole."
"And what would cause those local spikes, Senator?"
"You know that, Miles. Money is the key to everything. Economic downturns lead to a higher suicide rate, murder rate, and infant mortality, even on the wealthiest worlds. Human society is a fragile weave. If the pool of resources shrinks, we're at each other's throats." He nodded, his face growing lighter by the moment in the rising sun.
"So, when you trade tax relief and access protections, pushing around wealth in accordance with the grand secularist plan, what are you really trading?"
The bright sun had reached her face, and Nara Oxum closed her eyes. As often happened when she was out of synesthesia's reach, ghost images of old data danced before her eyes. She could reflexively visualize what Niles was saying. On a world of 1 billion people, a decrease of 1 percentage point in planetary product would result in well-established statistical shifts. Some 10,000 additional murders, 5,000 suicides, another 1 million in the next generation who would never leave the planet. The explanations for each tragedy were terribly specific: a broken home, a business failure, ethnic conflict. But the god of statistics swallowed the individual stories, smoothing the numbers into law.
"Of course," Niles interrupted her thoughts, "the process you're used to is rather more indirect than ordering soldiers to their deaths."
Oxum nodded. She had no will left to argue the point.
"I'd hoped you would cheer me up, Roger," she said.
He leaned forward.
"You did the right thing, Nara, as I said before. Your political instincts were correct, as always, and it's possible that the Council actually made the right military decision."
She shook her head. They'd condemned the Lynx without a clear reason.
"But here's what I was trying to say," Miles continued.
You've handled issues of this import before. I've traded in lives before, you mean.
His gaze swept down from the bright sky to the huge city. We are in the business of power, Senator, and power at this scale is a matter of life and death.
She sighed. Do you think they'll all die, Roger?
The crew of the Lynx? He asked.
The old advisor was looking straight at her. The sunrise had found his grey hairs, which glinted like strands of boyish red. She could tell that her anguish was revealed on her face.
It's Lawrence Zai, isn't it?
Oxum lowered her eyes, which was sufficient answer. She'd known that Niles would find out soon enough. He knew that Oxum's lover was a soldier, and there were a limited number of occasions when a secularist senator would come into contact with military personnel. The Emperor's parties were a matter of record, and they were monitored by an informal system of rumors, gossip sheets, and anonymous posts, all of which were filtered through celebrity news feeds. An intense and private conversation between a senator-elect and an elevated hero, no matter how brief, could not have gone unreported. Any doubts that Niles might have entertained would be vanquished once he'd uncovered that decade-old conversation. It must have been obvious to him why Nara was focused on the fate of the Lynx. She sighed, sadder still now. Her closest advisor knew that she had voted for the death of her lover. He leaned closer.
Listen, Nara, it will be safer for you if they all die cleanly.
Her eyes stung now. She tried to read Niles, but she'd had to up the dose of apathy in her bloodstream to cross the city, which was bright and sharp with war lust.
Safer? She managed after a moment. If the risen Emperor were to discover that one of his war counselors communicated privately with a commander in the field, one who then rejected a blade of error, Niles explained, he'd have her head on a stake.
She swallowed. I'm protected by privilege, Niles.
Like any legal construct, the Rubicon Pale is a fiction, Nara. Such fictions have their limits.
Oxum looked at her old friend aghast. The Pale was the basis of the Risen Empire's fundamental division of power. It was sacred. But Niles continued.
You're playing both sides, Senator, and that's a dangerous game.
She started to respond, but the council summons sounded in her head.
I have to go, Niles. The war calls me.
He nodded.
So it does. Just don't make yourself a casualty, Nara.
She smiled sadly. This is war, she said. People die.
Militia worker.
Rana Harta was happy here on the tundra. It had taken her a few days in the prefab to grasp and name the feeling. Before meeting the Rixwoman, happiness had only ever come to her in short, evanescent bursts. A few seconds when sunset drenched the sky in the smell of chamomile, a man's touch in the feathery moments before he became brutal. Those brief flashes of trumpet and copper on the tongue as Rana's brain bug took hold and the world emerged exact and clear. But the happiness she felt now was somehow sustained, awakening with her each morning, stretching across these long and listless nights she spent with Herd, constantly amazing Rana with its persistence. Like the whirls of her fingertips in a microscope, joy turned out to be entirely unfamiliar when viewed at this new and larger scale. Rana understood now that the happy moments of her earlier life had been furtive, truncated. Like a wild tundra hare, felicity had always bolted before she could grasp it, slipping across the bleak background of her life, a mere streak forever in peripheral vision. She had been ashamed of her mind's abilities, overawed by the beautiful but brutal natural world of her cold home province, embarrassed by the pleasure she took with men. But now Rana could actually witness her happiness directly, magnified through the lens of 11-hour Legis nights when Herd was released from duty. Rana Harta had discovered unimaginable new textures of contentment. She could count the grains in a teaspoon of spilled sugar, listen for hours to the moaning song of the incessant polar wind as it tested the walls of their cheap rented prefab. Even Herd's intense daily ministrations, shaving every part of her, cutting hair and nails, swabbing saliva, abrading skin, became rough pleasures. The Rixwoman's competent hands, her brittle conversation, and her strange bird-like movements were endlessly fascinating. Rana knew that Herd had given her a drug, and that the joy she felt had been forced upon her, leveraged by chemicals rather than events. She knew objectively that she should be terrified, suffering forcible confinement and isolation with a deadly alien. Rana even considered escape once,
out of an abstract sense of duty to the militia and her home planet, and from worry that the Rixwoman would eventually dispose of her. Rana had managed to dress herself, the fabric of her old clothes sensually harsh against raw skin. Warmth had required layers and layers. Herd always took their only winter coat to work at the facility. But when Rana opened the door to the prefab, the cold poured in with the blinding glare of the white tundra. The frozen vista of the polar waste muted any desire for freedom. It only reminded Rana how bleak her life had been before. She closed the door and turned the heat up to compensate for the inrush of frigid air, then took off the chafing clothes. She could not leave. But Rana never felt defeated here in this cabin. Somehow her mind seemed freed by captivity. It was as if her brain bug, no longer suppressed by shame, had finally been given the opportunity to develop to its true capacity. Rana loved teaching the Northern Legis 15 dialect to Herd. While her captor was away impersonating her, Rana spent the hours diagramming the structure of basic Imperial grammar, filling the prefab's cheap airscreen with webs of conjugations surrounded by archipelagos of slang, patois, and irregulars. Her student was an unbelievably quick learner. The commando's knowledge advanced nightly, Herd's flat, neutral accent taking on the rounded vowels of the tundral provinces. Rana demanded to be taught in return, insisting that knowledge of the Rix tongue would improve her tutoring of Herd. Rana also learned quickly, and they began to converse late into the night, Rana firing away with questions about Herd's upbringing, beliefs, and life in the Rix cult. At first, the commando resisted these attempts at companionship, but the cold and featureless Legis night seemed to wear away at her resolve. Soon, the conversation between hostage and captor became constant and bilingual, each speaking the other's language. At first, Rix was easy to learn. The core grammar of the language was artificial, created by compound minds to facilitate communication between planetary intelligences and their servants. But the language was designed to evolve quickly in human use, its streamlined phonology of clicks and pops infinitely malleable, able to embrace the unwieldy tenses of relativity or the chance matrices of the quantum. In Rana's mind, now constantly in a light brainbug fugue, the collectivity of things Rix began to take on a definite shape, flavor, smell. The clean lines of Herd's weapons, the icy sharpness of the woman's language, the whir of her servo motors, just audible when Herd was naked, the way hypercarbon melded into skin at her knees, elbows, and shoulders, all were of a piece. This Rix shape grew in Rana Harta's head, putting to shame the brain bugs of her earlier life, the mathematical parlor tricks to which the Empire put her ability. Here was the flavor of a whole culture, as deep and heady as some ancient whiskey perpetually under her nose. Rana watched her captor as if in love, pupils dilated with the dopamine coursing through her bloodstream, brilliant revelations growing within. After 3 days at the pole, Herd began to question Rana about Imperial entanglement technology. Under the current state of emergency, the entire polar facility was cut off from the Legis information web. Thus, the compound mind could only assist indirectly with whatever sabotage they were planning. Herd, a soldier rather than an engineer, was unable to affect the changes that the mind demanded. Rana tried to help with her limited understanding of the arrays used in microastronomy, but her answers often confused Herd. The underlying Rix concepts of quantum theory differed from the Imperial model. The two systems seemed fatally at odds. For one, the Rix standard model rendered the curves of discernible difference with a different number of dimensions than the Imperial, and their notion of discoherence escaped Rana altogether. So she put her hours of quiet happiness to work, beginning a study of translite communications. She found the Legis library unexpectedly helpful. Almost immediately, Rana found an expert program to help her. The expert bookmarked and highlighted the primary texts, guided her through the morass of beginner's texts to build on her elementary understanding of repeater arrays. The expert seemed to understand Rana, quickly learning to mold information into the form demanded by her brain bug, pulling in the chaotic, widespread data upon which her ability feasted. Herd brought home an attachment for the cabin's airscreen, a second-sight projector that allowed Rana to go into full synesthesia. She sank into the coils of data, willing prey. Herd had never told Rana exactly what the commando's mission was here at the pole, but her study seemed to guide itself. She found herself fascinated by the backup receivers that supported the facility, collecting the planet's conventional transmissions and forwarding them to the translite grid. There were many systems in place in case the hard lines were cut, but Rana was especially drawn to a colony of hardy, small, self-repairing machines that lived on the polar wastes around the facility. They were like the cheap, distributed arrays that Rana had used before in microastronomy, designed to survive Arctic winters, earthquakes, and acts of terrorism. After a few sleepless days, Rana collapsed into a sleep fugue that lasted some untold time. When she awoke, Herd was next to her, applying a cold rag to her fevered head. The usual joy of awakening filled her, heightened now with the surety of new knowledge. It was in the lemongrass flicker of Herd's eyes, the precision of her movements as she squeezed excess water from the rag, and it animated the shape of Rana's researchers in the cabin's airscreen. The flavor of her understanding reflected throughout the room. "The expert program," Rana said in the Rikstongue. "It's the compound mind, isn't it?" Herd nodded and answered quietly, "It is always with us." The sentence was one syllable in Rix. The commando held the red wig in one hand. Rana's own hair, removed so long ago, now seemed an alien artifact to her. The Rix woman fitted the wig onto Rana's head. It felt warm, as if fresh from an oven. It seemed to fit perfectly. "You will be Rana Harter tomorrow," Herd said. The thought of leaving the prefab terrified her. "But I don't even know what you want," Rana said, slipping into Legis dialect. The Imperial language felt crude, like thick porridge in her mouth. "Yes, you do," Rixwoman said. Rana shook her head. She thought hard in her native tongue. She knew nothing. As it had done all her life, confidence crumbled inside Rana. "I don't understand. I'm not smart enough." Herd smiled and touched the cold rag to Rana's forehead. With that contact, her anxiety lifted. Separate threads began to weave themselves together. The data from her guided exploration of repeater technology, the emerging shape and flavor of Rick's culture, the first bark and lemongrass of Herd's powerful and avian presence. And quite suddenly, Rana Harter knew the compound mind's desire. Herd's servomotors whirred as her hands moved across Rana. She was applying some sort of cream to Rana's embattled skin. The touch felt delicious, a balm against the fever of realization in her head. "Don't worry, my lucky find," the commando said. "Alexander is with you now." Alexander. The thing actually had a name. Rana touched her fingers to her own forehead. "Inside me?" "Everywhere." Executive officer. Catherine Hobbs let the water run into her glass in a thin, slow stream until it had filled to the brim. The tap stopped automatically before even a drop ran down the side. Water wasn't rationed here on board the Lynx, but wastefulness went against the aesthetics of the Navy. Hobbs turned from the sink in slow motion, her green eyes following each motion of her hand, carefully watching the wobble of the surface tension that held the water in the glass. She took the few steps that it took to cross the executive officer's private cabin, her movements an exaggerated pantomime. The glass felt strangely heavy, although the Lynx's high acceleration was, in theory, fully corrected. Was the extra weight a stress hallucination? Perhaps Hobbs's limbs were simply tired, beaten down by the constant microshifts of easy gravity. Or perhaps it was her disappointment. She hadn't had time to recover from Zai's revelation before the weight of high acceleration had settled painfully upon her. Normally, the vicissitudes of artificial gravity created only a vague disquiet in Hobbs, no worse than the motion sickness she'd experienced on the great sea-going pleasure craft of her utopian home. But the Lynx was currently accelerating at 10 Gs, and the slight flaws and inconsistencies of easy gravity were correspondingly magnified. The field patterns of easy gravity were a classic meta-chaotic system, mined with strange attractors, stochastic overloads, and a host of other mathematical chimeras. Fluctuations of mass on one side of a solar system could affect easy gravitations on the other, unpredictably, even fatally. It was not quite the case that the flutter of a butterfly's wings could cause a tornado, but the swift rotation of Legis System's seven gas giants and the massive solar flares of its sun constituted more than enough chaos to perturb Catherine Hobbs's inner ear. Hobbs could feel the effects of high acceleration in her joints as well. Every few minutes, something as simple as taking a step would go subtly wrong, as if the floor had come up slightly too hard to meet her foot. Or an object in her hand would jump from her grasp, as if suddenly pulled by an invisible hand. The stresses were rarely strong, but the constant unpredictability of normal events had gradually worn down her reflexes, fatiguing Hobbs's faith in reality. Now she mistrusted the simplest of actions, just as she mistrusted her own emotions. What a fool was Catherine Hobbs. Could she have really thought that Lawrence Zai was in love with her, even for a moment? When had that insane idea begun? She felt an idiot, a young idiot suffering a classic infatuation with a distant older authority figure. The whole episode had shaken her faith in herself, and the random jumps of gravity that plagued the Lynx weren't helping. She wished she could have a hot bath and curse the Navy for its disdain for this simple, necessary pleasure. At least she had other things to worry about. The flexing gravity around her was real enough and wielded outliers of lethal force. The night before, the marble chessboard in Hobbs's locker had suddenly, ear-splittingly cracked, rudely interrupting her fitful sleep. A few minor injuries had occurred on the Lynx in the first few days of acceleration. Ankle fractures and knee sprains were common. A young Marine's arm had broken without apparent cause, and burst blood vessels were visible in the eyes of a number of her shipmates. Catherine herself had suffered an unbearable and sudden headache the day before. It had passed quickly, but the intense pain was unnerving. With the ship's doctor dead, there was little hope for anyone suffering brain damage from some wayward tendril of gravity passing through their head. Hobbs walked carefully and reached the black lacquer table without spilling any of the water. Setting the glass on the table, she sat and watched the water's surface. It loomed just above the lip, quivering slightly. Was that some perturbation of the easy gravity field? Or simply the ambient vibration of the Lynx under high acceleration, marking the egress of photons from its churning engines? The water shuddered once, but the surface tension held. A few drops condensed on the side of the glass and traveled slowly downward. Nothing seemed to be out of order in that tiny segment of space. It gave Catherine a secure feeling to observe this localized example of soundness and normality. After a minute of watching, Hobbs picked up the glass and poured it slowly onto the table. The water seemed to turn black against the ebony lacquer. It formed into rivulets and small pools, seeking the imperceptible valleys of the table's contours. None was absorbed into the shiny blackness. The water's surface tension kept the drops large and rounded. On a dry island in this shallow sea, she placed the diamond Lawrence Zai had given her, a bright spot against its blackness. Hobbs set the half-full glass down and regarded the results. At first, the liquid seemed to come to rest, gathered in spattery puddles, with one tiny river reaching the edge and running from table onto floor. Then, Hobbs saw something move across the blackness, a wave of force, as if the table had been kicked. A few seconds later, one of the tendrils of water flexed in agitation, twisting like a beached fish. A single isolated droplet moved a few centimeters as if momentarily inhabited by a live spirit, and engulfed the tiny diamond. Then the water was still again. Hobbs waited patiently, and more flutters of motion came. Spread across the table's two dimensions, its passage on the lacquer almost frictionless, the spilled water writhed visibly with the microshifts of artificial gravity coursing through the Lynx. In its sinuous motion, it revealed gravitic lines of force like iron filings rendering the patterns of magnetism. It eased Catherine's mind to watch the water move. Now that she could actually see the invisible forces that had tortured her crewmates for the last week, Hobbs felt a bit more in control. She gazed at the black table, trying to scry some understanding from the patternless figures there. But easy gravitons were chaotic, complex, unpredictable. Like the ancients' concept of the gods, whimsical and obscure, pushing tiny humans around according to some incomprehensible plan. Not unlike, Catherine Hobbs reflected, the political forces that moved the Lynx across the black and empty canvas of space, placing them here at this nexus of a new war, condemning the captain, pardoning him, then sending them all careening toward death. Like the drops of water before her, the crew of the Lynx wriggled blindly against this void. An emotion that had seemed immense to Hobbs had become suddenly infinitesimal, laughable. On the scale of the universe, the aborted love of one executive officer for her captain made no ripples at all. Still, at this moment, Hobbs knew she hated Lawrence Zai with all her heart. When her door sounded, Catherine Hobbs started, banging her knee against the table's leg. "Come," she said, rubbing the leg, her latest wound. Second Gunner Thompson entered, taking slow, careful steps like a practiced alcoholic. He smiled when he saw the water-covered table. "Spill something?" I've been doing that all week.
Just an experiment, she said. He shrugged and pointed to the chair opposite her.